Well, in March of 2011, our family had the opportunity to escape an unyielding Erie winter and travel west to Arizona, back in the old days when you can get on an airplane and travel somewhere. Everyone was so much littler then, you see in this picture, but before we made our way to the mountains, we landed in Phoenix, and after our eyes adjusted to the strange glowing circle in the sky, we decided to take a walk around the hotel grounds. And next to the swimming pool was this grove of beautiful orange trees, plump, ripe oranges on every branch. Oh, did I mention that this grove had signs all around it warning the hotel guests to stay away? Now, you might not know this about my wife, Kim, because she's very responsible now, but I remember her when she was a total rebel back as a teenager. She was a punk rocker in high school. She wore black every day. She had half her head shaved. She listened to The Cure, okay? You get the picture? Well, something about those oranges made Kim's inner rebel come back out. She recruited our son, Chase, as her accomplice, and the two of them hatched a plan to pick and then eat one of those juicy oranges. And so with total disregard for my pastoral reputation and high moral standards, and with complete indifference toward our family's clean legal record, Kim and Chase moved in. And she helped him up onto that brick wall, and he reached out as far as his tiny arm would reach, and he snatched an orange off the tree, that beautiful forbidden fruit. And they quickly peeled the orange and immediately stuck a piece in their mouths with instant results. Coughing, gagging, spitting, tongue scrubbing. It turns out this is what's called, in those parts, a bitter orange. Now, apparently they're good when they're cooked down in some syrup for marmalades, but completely inedible in their raw form. Divine justice. But this fruit, it describes a lot of Christians. Beautiful on the outside, rotten on the inside. Jesus made a similar point in his lead up to our passage today when he said in Matthew 7:20, he said that you will recognize them, that is true Christians, you will recognize them by their fruits. And if the fruit is bad, that means the tree is bad. So we've used this series to go back to the basics of faith, straight to the words of Jesus. And today I want to answer the most basic of questions. What does it mean to be a true Christian? What does it mean to be saved? How do I get to heaven when I die? A lot of people would answer that question by saying, well, I just need to do enough good deeds, and then I'm going to somehow earn my way to God. Like, the way to heaven is by performing certain religious functions. If you accumulate enough good works, enough brownie points with God, then boom, you're in. Like, if you go on enough retreats or enough spiritual pilgrimages, or you pray enough prayers, or you get baptized as a baby, if you're confirmed, if you attend Mass or church services consistently without missing, if you participate in the sacraments, if you raise your hands in worship, if you get through catechism, if you read your Bible every day, that if you simply accumulate enough of these check marks on God's tally sheet, then you will finally earn his favor once and for all and get into the club. That if you keep all the rules along the way and consistently keep them, then you're going to earn your way into heaven. And as I've said every week, let me be very clear, Jesus never said that. In fact, he consistently pointed out that it's quite possible to go through all the motions, all of the religious rules, and still never have salvation. God is not some vending machine where we put in our good deeds and out come the blessings, or we put in our traditions and out come the favor. Jesus said that even if you go through all the religious traditions and rituals, it's actually possible to miss the most important thing, a relationship with him. And people get confused about this. It's why whenever you see a man on the street video and people are being asked, you know, why do you think you're going to heaven? The most common response is always this: I'm a good person. And what they're saying is, I've kept enough of the rules that when it comes time for God to decide, he's going to look at his little ledger sheet, and I'm going to have more good than bad on my tab, and he's going to let me in. This is one of the great deceptions in our day that most people believe. And so I want you to hear the words of Jesus. Right after he talked about good trees bearing good fruit, he continued his teachings with these sobering words in Matthew 7, starting in verse 21. He said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And on that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. And so Jesus is pointing out the difference in false and true Christians. He's issuing a warning. And the warning is that there are a lot of people who look like they are on the right path. They look religious on the outside. But when you peel back the layers, what appeared to be great fruit on the outside, they're like those beautiful bitter oranges that were rotten on the inside. And these folks are going to hear the most terrifying, unexpected verdict at the end of their lives when Jesus says, "Depart from me, I never knew you." And so I want you to see three sobering truths about external rule-keeping from this passage. You can say all the right things and still not know Jesus. That's the first. Look there in verse 21. These people are saying the right things. They're saying, "Lord, Lord." And in those days, it was illegal to call anyone Lord except Caesar. And so it was a sign of loyalty and allegiance to Jesus to call him Lord. And so by saying Jesus is Lord, they were speaking the right language. They were declaring their allegiance. And notice the name Lord. It's repeated twice, Lord, Lord. In Semitic language, when you repeat a name, it's a sign of emotional connection. And so when David wept over his dead son, he said, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom." Jesus said about his, "Mary, Mary." It's a term of endearment. And so these people were saying all the right words, but just because you can say all the right Christian words doesn't mean that you really know Jesus. You can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? Well, it appears that these people were walking some religious walk too. Here's the second sobering truth. You can build an impressive spiritual resume and still not know Jesus. Check out the list in verse 22. They're saying, "Listen, we prophesied, we cast out demons, we performed many mighty works." That's impressive. I mean, let's just do a quick resume check here among us. Have you ever stood up and given a word of prophecy to a group of people? A handful of us, maybe. How about cast out a demon? I haven't, but I've seen it happen, and the person I watched was pretty spiritually impressive. So you have to be pretty high up on the religious food chain to be casting out demons. It says they did many mighty works in verse 22. These people were doing ministry. They were seeing results. They came to the prayer meetings. They saw the miracles. They went on the mission trips. They were deep into it. The third sobering truth is this. You can think that you're going to heaven and still not go. This may be the most shocking part of this whole story. Notice how surprised these people are. "Didn't we do all these things in your name?" they say. They're pleading their case with God. Like, we did all this stuff. We scored perfect on our theology exams. We prayed the prayers. We did the ministry. We were baptized and confirmed. Our pastor definitely thought we were true Christians. What gives, Jesus? And so this is the tricky part, you see. On the outside, everything looks the same between the good and the bad, just like that orange. That's what makes this so difficult. Jesus isn't making comparisons like, you know, between the one guy who worships Jesus and the one guy who sits at home and smokes dope and plays Led Zeppelin records backwards. That was a sign of a really bad person in the early 80s. Jesus didn't say, you know, the difference is between one guy who loves his neighbor and the other guy who kicks his neighbor's dog. These would be easy. But in this case, the bad guy looks just like the good guy on the outside. They both call Jesus Lord. It's only when you look on the inside that you see that they're totally different. Well, that's all pretty terrifying, isn't it? Is it only me that finds that terrifying? I don't think so. What did these guys do that was so wrong? I mean, they said all the right stuff. They did all the right stuff. What's the problem here? Well, if you look at verse 23, Jesus identifies it. He says, "I never knew you." This is an intimate term. To know someone means you're intimately connected to them. And so let me talk to you for our remaining time about a few things that you should know about knowing Jesus. The first is this, that it's a relationship, not rules, rituals, or religion. These people knew of Jesus. They knew his name. They knew his ministry. They knew about how the game worked. But they didn't actually know Jesus. There was never a relationship. They never loved Jesus for Jesus' sake. They served him, but apparently it wasn't out of love. It was because they wanted something from him. That they had kept all the rules, and they thought that would satisfy him. They thought if they went through all the motions, that God would give them a better life, or that he would give them a get-out-of-hell-free card. If they just followed this certain code of conduct, maybe they could keep God off their back. But that's not how love works. Think of it like marriage. If I looked at Kim and said, "Woman," now in real life, that's where it would end, but go with me. "Woman, what I really need from you are some babies, 3 meals a day, and a clean house." Again, put aside the fact that if I actually said this, I would no longer possess key body parts. "This is what I need from you." Imagine I approached it that way. I just said, here's what I need. Now, what do I have to do for you so that you'll give me these things? Oh, okay. Be home every night by 6, all right? Yeah. You want $500 a week of my money for clothes and other essentials? Okay. No golf, all right? Home on Saturdays. Some flowers and chocolate from time to time. Oh, lots of chocolate? Okay, lots of chocolate. And some of you are like, I think I could live with this list. But guys, that's not marriage. That's a business transaction. I'll do this if you give me that. And I think that's what these guys were doing with God. They were serving him as a means to a better life or a way to escape hell. But that's not Christianity. It's not about keeping all the rules. And so I get something at the end. He's inviting us into a love relationship. And so, should we do ministry and get baptized and raise our hands and worship and find our chair and make care packages for the poor and encourage the frontline workers? Like all that stuff that we talk about around here? Yes, absolutely yes. But we don't do it to earn his love. We do it in response to his love. It's not to obtain salvation. It's in light of the gift of salvation that's already been given to us. Just like I don't try to be home by 6 and on Saturdays and get flowers and chocolates because I'm checking off a list. It's because I'm in a love relationship. I'm compelled to do those things because Kim is the love of my life. I want to spend time with her. I want to give her my best. So knowing Jesus is only possible when you're in a relationship with Jesus. Okay, here's the second thing to know. You can fool people, but you can't fool God. Jesus was constantly challenging the religious leaders of the day. You know, these are the great rule keepers of the day. And they had everyone fooled. But listen to what Mark 7, 5 through 8 says. It says, so the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands? They're talking about cleansing laws. And he replied, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. Woo, shots fired. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You have let go of the commands of God, and you're holding on to human traditions. And so Jesus calls them hypocrites. The word hypocrite was actually originally used in Greek theater, referring to one actor who would wear multiple masks to impersonate various different roles throughout a play. A hypocrite is someone who's pretending to be something they're not. And so Jesus is saying, you're all walking around with masks trying to impress, but your heart hasn't been changed. How many of you know people still wear masks? There's a funny story about a guy desperate for a job, and he read that there was an opening at his local zoo. And so he went into the zoo to apply. And the woman during the interview told him, listen, we only have one position that's open. Last week, our very popular gorilla died. Lots of people come to the zoo to see the gorilla, and we don't have the funds to replace him with a real, authentic gorilla. And so we would like you to be paid to put on a gorilla suit and to get in a cage and pretend to be a gorilla. And the guy was a little offended. You know, his mother didn't raise him to be a gorilla, but he was desperate for work. And so he put on the gorilla suit, he went into the cage. And at first he wasn't too excited about his new job, but the more he was in there and the more he saw people pointing and laughing at his movements, the more he started kind of getting into it. And soon the crowds were quite convinced by his behavior that this was a real gorilla. And so one day he was swinging, you know, on the vines, and he got a little enthusiastic, and he swung right over the top of the wall of his cage into the next cage, which happened to be the lion cage. And as he lay there on the ground, he looked around hoping that the lion was asleep, but no luck. In an instant, the lion was on top of him. He could feel the hot breath of the lion in his face. And in that moment, he no longer cared about his job. He broke character completely. The whole hoax went out the window. And in his panic, he started to scream, help me, get me out of here, save me from this hungry lion. And it surprised the crowds to hear a gorilla screaming such things. But almost instantly, the man heard the lion on top of him whisper, shut up, you idiot, or we'll both get fired. Right? Not one authentic animal in the entire zoo. Everyone was pretending, everyone wearing masks, putting on a big show. And so Jesus confronts the fakers, and he says, listen, you might be able to fool other people, but you can't fool God. And on the day you stand before him, the truth is going to come out. And so if you're honoring God with your lips, but your heart is far from him, he's going to know it. So he seems to point out that the religious leaders And he's saying this, that all their rule-keeping, it's not getting them anywhere. But at the beginning of this same Sermon on the Mount, Jesus also said this kind of confusing phrase. It's in Matthew 5:20. He said this, he said, I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. And so wait a minute. It seemed like Jesus was relaxing the rules. And here in this passage, it sounds like he's actually ramping up the rules. Our righteousness has to exceed theirs. And yes, it does. So what is righteousness? Well, it just means right standing before God. In fact, to be in the presence of God, he demands perfection. You see, God is perfect. He's perfectly holy. He's perfectly righteous. In fact, if you want to go the route of earning God's favor by keeping all the rules, you can try. The problem is you'll have to keep them perfectly. That's what the Pharisees tried to do, and they failed. And I hate to break it to you, but you will too. Our righteousness, he says, needs to be greater than theirs. God demands perfection. And this is the issue with those people who say, well, I'm a good person, so I'm going to get into heaven. Like when I stand on the good and bad scale at the end of my life, I'm hoping that the good works outweigh the bad, and then I'm in. I'm certainly not like, you know, Hitler or Mussolini or my jerk of a neighbor. I'm a good person. Well, a long time ago, I heard Bill Hybels use this illustration. I've used it in many conversations since with people who say, I'm a good person and I'm going to heaven. So I'll typically start off with the person that I'm talking to and I'll say, listen, here's a scale from 0 to 10. And I want, this is the goodness scale. This is the righteousness scale, the moral scale. And so if we think about the goodness of God, where does God fall on this scale? Well, of course, God is right up here at the top. He's a 10. He's perfect and holy in every way. And so then typically what I'll do is I'll hand this person a pencil or a pen or whatever and just say, okay, so what I want you to do is I want you to put the Hitlers and the Mussolinis and the and you know the jerk of a neighbor on the scale. And so he'll typically come down here to, you know, maybe below one. They're barely making the scale. So down here is Hitler, and down here is Stalin and people like that. They're barely on the scale. Evil people. And they'll typically put his neighbor, you know, just north of those guys. So my next question is, okay, well, where will you put yourself on the scale? I mean, you just said that your good deeds are going to be what gets you into heaven. It's going to impress God enough to let you in. And so where would you put yourself on the scale, being this good person that you claim to be? And so they'll typically come up here and say, you know, I'm probably between a 7 and an 8. That's me. I'm up in here. Okay. Now here's where it gets awkward, because I said, okay, could I have the pen back? And I say, now, who do you think is the most, you know, spiritual or godly person who ever lived? You know, who are those people that are, you know, really impressive on this earth spiritually? And they'll usually say somebody like Mother Teresa, or they'll say somebody like Billy Graham. And I'll say this in response. I'll say, listen, I've really followed the work of those figures like that. And I've read most of their books. I've even read through some of their personal diaries. And I know for a fact that people like Mother Teresa and Billy Graham, they kind of relate to the words of that song in Amazing Grace that says, you know, that he saved a wretch like me. They would consider themselves to be kind of a wretched person. I say, I would venture to say that if Billy Graham or Mother Teresa were given this pen and asked to put themselves on the scale, they'd probably stick themselves, you know, somewhere around a 3. Billy Graham, you know, Mother Teresa. Those guys, probably down here around a 3. They think that God did a great work in saving them. And if they answer somebody like, well, maybe the Apostle Paul or someone like that, okay, great. You know, here we have the writer of most of the New Testament. This is an impressive person from history. And I'll say back to them, but here's the thing I know about the Apostle Paul. He actually had a title that he had given himself. And the title was this, the chief of sinners. He said, of all the sinners in the world, I am the chief sinner. And so I think if we ask the Apostle Paul to put himself on here, the chief sinner, you know, he would probably be somewhere either a little bit below or a little bit above Mother Teresa or Billy Graham. There we have the Apostle Paul. Let's put him right in the same category. And this is where it gets really awkward, because I'll look to the person and I'll say, you may be wondering about me. And I'm no one compared to these folks, but I've committed most of my life, I mean, the last 25 years leading a church. I've seen hundreds of people baptized, thousands of people come to faith in Jesus. I've preached the gospel in a bunch of countries all over the world. But I'm a nobody compared to these guys. And so I would probably put Derek Sanford down here somewhere south of all these big-time people, but a little bit north of your jerk of a neighbor. And then I turn back to them and say, okay, so I know you're looking pretty impressive up here at your 7.5, but I want to give you one more chance to reconsider, okay? And so if you want to, why don't you rethink kind of where you fall on the scale? And it goes from there, because there is a huge righteousness gap when it comes to all of us and the perfection of God. We have to take very seriously and feel the weight of Paul's statement in Romans 3, 10 and 11 when he says, none is righteous. No, not one. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. No one does good. Not even one. So the person who says, but I'm a good person, Paul's saying here, no one does good. Not even one. And it's like, well, shoot, what do we do with that gap? What do we do with that big gap between the two or three or four that we are and the 10 that God is? And on the one hand, we have Jesus saying that our righteousness needs to exceed the scribes and Pharisees. And on the other hand, it seems like the Bible saying that righteousness is not even possible. Where does that leave us? Like, if we don't earn our salvation by keeping all the rules, how do we get from here to there? So here's the third thing I want us to see. To know Jesus, you need a new heart. It's not about keeping the rules. In fact, you can't keep the rules. Until the human heart undergoes a radical transformation, all the outward efforts, all the rule-keeping, all the image management, all the self-regulating, it won't be enough. The human heart is where the change needs to begin. Jesus always took an inside-out approach to our sin problem. And so when he said, your righteousness has to exceed the scribes and Pharisees, he wasn't saying that you need to do better than them at keeping all the rules. And so then what does he mean? How do we solve the righteousness gap between us and God? Listen how Paul says it in 2 Corinthians 5:21. He says this, for our sake, God made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. That in him, in Jesus, we might become the righteousness of God. The cross is the answer. When Jesus, the one who knew no sin, became sin for us, that's when it was possible for you and me to become the righteousness of God, to receive a new heart, to move all the way up the goodness scale to 10, so that when God looks at you, he sees the righteousness of Jesus because of what Jesus purchased for you on the cross. And so it's not by earning our way through a bunch of good deeds. How do we, you know, get salvation? And so how is it? How do we access this salvation? Well, there was a religious leader in the Bible who had this same question. His name was Nicodemus, and his story is found in John chapter 3. He was a very, very important, very wealthy, very well-connected man. Nicodemus had it all together. He was Ivy League educated. He was morally upright. He knew his Bible, probably had it memorized. He had amassed more good deeds than you and I combined, probably. He was a good person, but he wasn't going to heaven. And so he snuck out one night to see Jesus. He was trying to piece together who Jesus was and how to access this new kingdom. And Jesus said to him and to all of us who might wonder how to access this salvation, Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And so it's not the good deeds. It's not the impressive ministry. It's not that I've prophesied and cast out demons and did mighty deeds in your name. It's being born again. And Nicodemus presses for clarification and even asks a kind of funny question. He says, am I supposed to get in my mother's womb again? Born again, what does that mean? Like, he went straight literal with it. He's thinking, my mom's old and I'm way bigger than I was the first time around. He's imagining the phone call. Hey, mom, I know this is out of the blue, but you'll never believe what Jesus told me to do. No. Get it out of your head. Jesus is cutting through all the stuff. And he says, you need to start over with God. You don't need a teacher, you don't need a mentor, you don't need a life coach, you need a savior. And he goes on to verse 5 and he says, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. He goes on in verse 6, that which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit. Don't marvel that I said to you, you must be born again. And so some people come to Jesus and they think, I need to make some changes in my life, or I need to turn over a new leaf, or I'm hoping for a bit of a new lease on life. And Jesus comes along and says, you don't need a little reform. You need a whole new start. And just like that little heart in you was formed for the first time in your mother's womb, you need a new heart the second time. And the birth imagery is such a perfect and vivid descriptor of how this happens. Because think about it. Who brings about a birth? Not the baby. Like when you were born the first time, you weren't the one that showed up at a hospital and said, hey, I'm here to get born, right? A birth is something that happens to you. A baby comes only through someone else's labor. A baby only comes through a mother's pain. The baby doesn't do a thing. It's all the mother's work. It's that mother who bore the weight for all those months. It's the mother who had all the nausea, all the back pains, all the sleepless nights from getting up to pee. Stay with me. For you to be physically born, someone else suffered. Someone else labored. Someone else was burdened. Someone else was in anguish. Someone else was bleeding. Are you picking up what I'm putting down here yet? In the same way, you can't make yourself a Christian through your good works. For you to be spiritually born, it's not you who did it. Your good works can't pull it off. Your keeping of enough of the rules to check enough boxes won't do it. Jesus did it. It's his anguish that did it. It's his pain that did it. It's his blood that did it. It's all him. The spiritual birth is something that happens to you. And so what you do is you receive it. You surrender to it. You hear how intimate this is. It's like a mother giving birth. How far removed from rules this is, which is why you can't admire Jesus from afar. You don't follow him from a distance. You don't say, oh, Jesus was a great teacher. Jesus was an admirable moral leader or the founder of some religion. You say, he gave me life. He gave me spiritual breath. He gave me a new heartbeat. And because he did, I believe in him. I trust him. I put all my faith in him. I surrender all of my will to all of his will. I give him the steering wheel of my life. He's calling the shots now. Guys, you have no chance of going to heaven because of what you've done, but only by what has been done on your behalf. You don't get to heaven by piling up enough good works, but by repenting of your sin and being born again. Nicodemus, the Pharisee, realized this, and apparently he placed his hope in Jesus. Because we see him one other time in the Bible. It's at the foot of the cross. He followed Jesus all the way to his death, at who knows what personal cost. And while the disciples fled the scene in fear, it was Nicodemus and a guy named Joseph of Arimathea who risked everything, and they took Jesus' body and they laid him in a tomb. And from that tomb set the stage for the greatest event in human history, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Two rich dudes had their worlds rocked by Jesus, and it changed everything. And I don't know where you're at today. Maybe you're a rich dude yourself, or maybe you're a drunk, maybe you're an addict, maybe a shop worker or a stay-at-home mom. Maybe you're at a low point in your life, or maybe you're flying high. But the beauty of Jesus is that he levels the field. None of us are worthy of his grace. That's why it's called grace. Salvation is not something you earn by following all the rules. Jesus never said that. Salvation is a gift from God. And the Bible says that salvation is activated by an act of faith. The Bible says that it's by grace you have been saved, listen, through faith. And so I want to give you an opportunity right now in our socially distanced world to activate God's salvation in your life. I invite you to come to him just as you are, and he will save you. He will make you a new creation. And some of you have been considering this for a while, and today you have a chance to close the deal. You need to say, I'm not going to trust in my church attendance. I'm not going to trust in the money I've given to charity or my good deeds or who I'm related to or what my grandma thought. Today, I want to be born again of the Spirit. And for you, this pandemic isn't a pause button. It's a reset button. Born again, new life, time for a whole new beginning. And listen, there are those of you who have already taken that initial step of faith, but you realize that you've become a bit like the bitter orange. You look like you have your faith together on the outside, but inside it's just not good. You've just been playing the game. And the greatest thing that you can do to walk out on authentic faith is to get into a group, right now a digital life group, where you can be real, where people can call you out, where you can be encouraged, where you can learn the scriptures, where you can have a brotherhood and a sisterhood to walk out your faith together. And so here's what I'm asking you to do today, all of you, by way of a next step. Would you take out your phone and would you text the word Grace Next to 94090? And when you receive a text back, you'll have a choice. And if today is the day you want to be born again, to follow Jesus for the very first time, choose number one. Just says, I want to follow Jesus. He's eager to receive you. And if you'd like more information about a digital life group, choose number two, and we'll get you where you need to go to make that happen. I love you guys so much. I'm praying that many of you will take that step of faith today. I can't wait to see you all again in person someday soon. God bless.